This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. When you say Christopher Plummer, some people automatically think Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music. But that's only one of about 100 films Plummer has made. And he's just written about his life and career in a new memoir, which comes out next week. It's called In Spite of Myself. Christopher Plummer's recent films include The Insider, A Beautiful Mind, Syriana, and Inside Man. Next year, he'll star opposite Johnny Depp in the new Terry Gilliam film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. In addition to his movie work, Plummer has enjoyed a long and successful career on stage. He's won 2 Tony Awards and has performed with Britain's National Theatre and the Royal Shakespeare Company. Terry spoke with Christopher Plummer in 2007.
Christopher Plummer, welcome to Fresh Air. It seems to me in your life, you just keep getting better roles. You've been in a lot of interesting movies in the past few years.
Yes, I have, which is great because once I hit the character actor level, scripts started to improve as they came my way.
Is there any movie that you see as like a turning point in the latter part of your career?
Uh-huh. I think The Insider was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent my life on the stage and I'd done tons of film, both in England, Europe, and here. But another level started to be reached after The Insider, and the scripts that I was receiving were now much more intelligent and of an A level rather than a B plus.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned The Insider because we just happen to have a clip from it.
Oh, whoop.
Yeah, and this film, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's about The Insider is played by Russell Crowe. He's a whistleblower who had worked as a scientist at a tobacco company. And he knows all the secrets about the poisonous additives and all that stuff. So he's talking to 60 Minutes about it. But this is the very beginning of the story in which your producer, Lowell Bergman, played by Al Pacino, has been setting up an interview for you with an Islamic extremist. And at this point, you step in as Mike Wallace to actually ask the questions, and you want to create the rules, but of course the Islamic group wants to create the rules. So here's how the interview gets started.
He says you must not sit so close.
What? I can't conduct an interview from back there.
You must move back your chair.
Well, you tell him that when I conduct an interview, I sit anywhere I damn please.
There is no interview.
You!
I'm talking to you.
What
the hell do you think I am, a 78-year-old assassin? You think I'm going to karate him to death with this notepad?
Are you interpreting
what I'm saying?
Yes.
We're there. Good. Well, ask him if Arabic is his second language.
It's my guest, Christopher Plummer, in a scene from The Insider. How did you get the part in The Insider, which you say, you know, was a turning point in your film career?
Well, they sent me the script. I'm sure they sent it to others as well, but I got it, and I met Michael and Al, and I was in. It was just wonderful.
And did you start watching a lot of 60 Minutes? Did you meet Mike Wallace?
I knew Mike Wallace, and he'd interviewed me in the past. I also grew up with Mike Wallace. He was one of the early hardcore television personalities. And I watched him continuously when I was in my 20s, in the 50s, and when he began. And it was always very exciting to watch that kind of television. It was really probably what the medium was for, a kind of expose medium in which people got into the core, sometimes cruelly or not, of someone's persona. And Mike was an expert at it, as was John Freeman in England.
Now, another film that you did in recent years was Syriana. in which you're the head of a big law firm representing an oil company with interests in the Middle East. And they're looking at a power change in a small Gulf country, and they want their own man in power so they can call the shots. So they're trying to help this young, weaker prince who they think they can tell what to do. I want to play a scene in which you're talking with that prince.
Prince,
is there
anything that we can do for you?
Americans always happy to drill holes in other people's countries. I've heard of you, Mr. Whiting, the cat's paw of the Saudi princes.
I know your brother, the foreign minister. He's very bright. I know your father, too. He threw the second creepiest party I've ever been to in Washington. And as far as I can see, you could probably use a bit of the cat's paw yourself. Second-born son, so beaten down by his family, he can't even tell me what he wants when he's asked straight out. A grown-up baby who's afraid of his brother? And maybe he wants to be king? Maybe? Well, Prince, are you a king? Can you tell me what you want?
Well, Christopher Plummer, hearing your scenes from The Insider and from Syriana, I just started wondering, have you ever played someone in a movie who's sweet-tempered, sensitive, and shy?
Yes, of course I have. Of course I have. I've made over 125 movies, and I think in them you'll find some of them sweet, darling, sensitive, and shy. Yeah, I have done a few of those parts, of course.
But you seem in recent years to really have kind of specialized in those really, like, power or assertive roles. No one's going to push me around kind of roles.
Yes, I suppose. But those parts interest me. They're witty. They've got a wonderful edge to them. And I think people think that I exude a sort of power. So they keep casting me in these things.
Well, we've got one more clip for you. And this one is inevitable. So the movie that made you famous, The Sound of Music, 1965, which you were Captain Von Trapp, a widow who expects his children to behave as if they were in the military until you get a new governess, played by, of course, Julie Andrews. And this is the scene in which she comes to your door, you meet her for the first time, and you're trying to evaluate her and also give her directions on how to handle the kids.
Now, Fräulein Maria, I don't know how much the Mother Abbess has told you.
Not much.
You are the 12th in a long line of governesses who have come to look after my children since their mother died. I trust that you will be an improvement on the last one. She stayed only 2 hours.
What's wrong with the children, sir?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the children. Only the governesses. They were completely unable to maintain discipline. Without it, this house cannot be properly run. You will please remember that, Fräulein?
Yes, sir.
Every morning you will drill the children in their studies. I will not permit them to dream away their summer holidays. Each afternoon they will march about the grounds, breathing deeply. Bedtime is to be strictly observed, no exceptions.
Excuse me, sir, when do they play?
You will see to it that they conduct themselves at all time with the utmost orderliness and decorum. I'm placing you in command.
Yes, sir.
Christopher Plummer and Julie Andrews in a scene from The Sound of Music. People have such strong feelings about that movie. They either love it or they hate it and they think it's really insipid. Where do you stand on this issue of our time?
I'm very fond of Julie. That's the nicest thing that came out of that film for me. We have a true and great friendship. She's an extraordinary woman and professional. I'm grateful to the film in many ways because it was such a success. It is not my favorite film, of course, because I do think it borders on mawkishness, but we did our damned best not to make it too mawkish, and Robert Wise kept a very tight control on it, which was difficult enough. The sound and the music is quite wonderful. The only two countries that really didn't like it were Austria, of course, and Germany. Austria was fed to the teeth with the fact that they'd seen so many documentary films about the Trapp family that they'd had them up to here.
You know, in your movies, you have such good diction, such proper diction in some of your roles. I almost thought you were from England. You're from Canada. Is the diction a result of theater training? Is it a class thing?
No, it's to do with my family, who spoke well. I mean, we speak well in Canada as well as they do in Great Britain, may I remind you.
Mm-hmm.
And my family were educated, well-read, and they spoke beautiful English. So I really got a lot from them, and of course, theater training continued to make it better.
Now, you were a member of two very famous British theater groups, the National Theater and the Royal Shakespeare Company. What years were you in England?
I lived in England from 1961 right through into almost the mid-70s.
Oh.
So about 15 years, yeah.
Okay. So you worked in a period when the Method became very popular in the United States. But
yeah.
You were also doing classical theater. So you were doing classical theater and movies in which a lot of the actors were into the Method. Did you find yourself going back and forth between more of a classical approach and more of a Method approach to acting?
Well, I think both. I think they one helped the other. I'm so glad that... I'm so glad I was Canadian in a way, because the Canadian can take the best of the British and the best of the American school. And we're rather good at that. We're kind of like chameleons in that respect. That's why there's so many good Canadian comics and mimics. Terrific. So that was valuable, to use the Method and use the classical technique together at the same time. It was very exciting.
How would you describe the main difference between the two approaches?
The Method in itself has been, I think, heavily misunderstood. I've always thought that. The Method is really there for an actor who is in trouble and who can't rustle up an emotion that he's trying to get or that the author requires him to get. So he uses sense memory and things that the Method suggests you use to some personal experience in his family or some tragedy. He uses that to infuse the lines that he's having trouble with. But if you're an actor, for God's sake, the whole reason for being an actor is that you have an imagination and intelligence and some sort of instinct of your own, and you don't need to follow the Method.
Now, early in your screen career, you were actually on television, and you did a lot of the early TV shows.
The golden age of television, yes, in New York.
Like General Electric Theater and Kraft Theater.
Oh, yeah, all of them. I did them all, yeah.
And a lot of those were live, right? Or all of them were live?
All of them were live. Tape didn't come in until the late 50s, I don't think.
Do you have any really good stories about doing live drama on television in the 50s?
Well, yeah. I can't remember the name of the show, but Martin Manulis was the producer and director. And we were doing, this time, Meierling, the story of Crown Prince Rudolf of Habsburg and his suicide attempt with Maria Vecchera, his lover. And the setting was in the hunting lodge, and... on the night of the show, live, of course, Vivica Lindfors was such a beautiful Swedish actress, and she was playing Maria Vecchera, an immense crush on her. And the night came before I was supposed to make my entrance into the hunting lodge, and she is waiting for me. And the poor thing had to wait and wait and wait, because off stage, I couldn't see anything. It was all black. So finally I saw a light at the end of this long sort of black hole, and I thought, oh, thank God, at last I can find an entrance and make my entrance. So I sort of bent down and came out of it. But the audience must have been very startled to see Crown Prince Rudolf with all his medals coming out through the fireplace.
So what did you do to cover it up? Anything?
No, we just valiantly went on with it. But her face was something extraordinary. She didn't dream I was going to come through that thing.
That sounds such a nightmare, though. You know, it's like live TV and you can't find the entrance to the stage.
Oh, it's awful. But the cameramen were so great in those days, because I was on a long soap opera once, and it was so bad I can't remember its name and refuse to remember its name. But they were so great. There were only four of them, you know, four cameras. And then we never knew our lines. So that when we forgot a line, we'd wink at the cameraman, and the cameraman would then go and shoot a vase or something on a table or a grand piano, and while we quickly looked at the script and nodded, and then he came back and we finished the scene. But that happened all the time. But it was beautiful. They'd mastered it so smoothly, these cameramen. They were heroes.
Now, you've performed Shakespeare as a young man. You've performed Shakespeare as an older man, most recently as King Lear on Broadway. Does Shakespeare read differently to you now than it did when you were young? Are there things you see in it now that you didn't then, or interpretations that are different?
Well, of course there are, but the poet himself remains as magical and as extraordinary and as simple and as human as he did when I was young, because that's what strikes you right away, is the humanity of the plays when you're and the simplicity of them when you're a young person. That's why he's head and shoulders above all the other writers that wrote at his time particularly, because they're much more florid and grandiloquent. And Shakespeare is so extraordinarily simple. And that stays with you always. Of course, as you grow older and you have some experience of life, you see more into the depths of each character. King Lear, for instance, which is an extraordinary play. It's so very modern in its dysfunctional family and all the trappings of power that are disappearing from. I mean, it's so modern, it's so human. You need to be much older to understand the depths of a part like that.
I never think of Shakespeare as being simple.
Oh, yes. I mean, oh, no, come on. When he picks the great moments, the key moments in plays, his language becomes terribly simple. You notice that.
Give me an example.
Well, I mean, nothing could be simpler than "The Rest is Silence." That's as modern a statement as there ever was.
You said that you used to drink a lot.
Yes.
That was a very enthusiastic yes. Was this mostly like in the 1950s and 60s?
Yeah, that was the good drinking era. Then the 60s sort of became more of a drug era, didn't it? And then the 70s were so boring I can't remember them. But the 50s was a very communicative era. Everybody loved their drink. New York was wide open, so was Montreal. In fact, Montreal stayed open 24 hours a day. There wasn't a joint in town that closed. And I used to, you know, commute shuttle back from both. It was a glorious time, and we were all us young actors, my friends, Jason Robards, we're all big drinkers. Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole, all of us were good, hard-fisted drinkers. And our intention was that we should be, if we were to be called men, we must be drink as much as we can. And if we can still get through Hamlet the next day without a hitch, that made you a man, my son. That you weren't worth anything unless you could do the test of time.
Is it harder to do Hamlet with a hangover?
Terrible. It's just a nightmare, and I have done it with a hangover, yeah. It was very fast, though. We did it very fast. We got off very quickly. It was no longer a 3.5-hour, 4-hour play. It was something like 2 hours.
What would you do to make yourself feel better before having to do Hamlet or any kind of heavy lifting with a hangover?
Fernabranca was my favorite pick-me-up. Fernabranca laced with a little creme de menthe. It goes down like silk, and boy, does it wake you up. And if you have another one, if you have two or three Fernabrancas, you're drunk again. So just stick to one and you'll be okay.
And you wouldn't forget your lines with that?
No, somehow Hamlet remained intact in my memory. It was such a glorious play that I wouldn't insult it by forgetting it.
Are there any roles you'd still particularly like to play? There's a lot of roles you don't know about because they haven't been written yet, but is there any particular thing you have your sights on?
Well, I hope somebody actually does write some role that really is a wonderful role. There aren't many. It's an ensemble time now. And as Nathan Lane said so succinctly, I don't do ensemble. But Yeah, there's tons of stuff I want to play. I want to play some Chekhov. And yes, I want to do things like Prospero. I want to do Volpone. I've got tons of parts that I want to play before I croak.
Well, Christopher Plummer, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.